Welcome back, everybody. We've been reminding folks that this is a new track for this year, which is the end user track, and we are encouraging everyone to encourage more real world end users next time. So remember May in Ottawa. Moving forward, particularly focused on tiling and collateral damage, both Joshua Brickman, who heads up the security evaluations. Oh, next slide. I'm sorry. I'm not the good monkey here. both Joshua and Glenn, of course, bring a lot of history and a lot of knowledge to their work in leading out at Oracle, both with experience in the cybersecurity side and, of course, in the evaluations. So I think, with no further ado, help me welcome both Glenn and Joshua.
Thank you, everyone. Good morning. Today, our session on collateral damage is going to actually have two key parts. The first part, which I'll be speaking to, is going to be focused on customer perspectives, things that we've seen. So my previous role within Oracle, up until very recently, was focused on the public sector space, so government, higher education, healthcare for North America. And so I worked with customers all the time on cybersecurity requirements, compliance issues, and things like that. And I want to share some of those experiences with you. Following that, I'll pass the baton to Josh, who will provide some additional perspectives as a vendor, as Oracle, and then we'll follow up together for recommendations and Q&A. So just a little bit of background on Oracle. I don't want to spend too much time here, and but I think it's important to understand. You know, Oracle is nearly a 40-year-old company. Started out with one product. And when you have one product, it's a lot different than how it is today. So through both acquisition and an organic development, Oracle has expanded quite a bit. And so today we have thousands of products. Products that range from microprocessors and tape drives and hardcore kind of computer and IT hardware, all the way up through the database, which is kind of where we started, the operating systems, the virtualization, all the way up into business applications, even applications specifically designed for specific industries. This makes the FIPS 140 landscape very challenging, and I'm going to touch on that in a little bit. One of the other things, though, that's important is the understand from the customers that we deal with. You know, we have an international customer base. It's not just U.S. and Canada. They care about cryptography very much, but it's not always specifically in the context of FIPS 140. The products are used. These thousands of products are used in a variety of capacities, development, test, QA, production. And it's important to understand that when things are used in production, especially when you're talking about big ERP systems, HR systems, finance systems, these things tend to stay in place and change very little for 5 years, 10 years, sometimes more. I was just having a discussion with one of our industry leads who works with the life sciences, and they're explicitly told, once we set up these clinical trials, we can't touch these systems for 10 years. Well, obviously, that's going to have an impact on changing regulations, changing requirements, especially as it relates to things like FIPS 140. So I want to drill down in terms of Oracle and FIPS 140 before jumping into the customer side of things. Oracle has been conducting FIPS 140 validations for quite some time, both itself and some of its acquired companies. We've done a lot of validations on our own paper. So we've worked with things like Solaris and the storage tech drives, the Acme packet, which was an acquisition, a session border controller. And so we have a lot of hands-on experience doing those FIPS 140 validations, but it's important to understand that we also leverage quite a lot of third-party modules in support of FIPS 140 compliance. We have products that use RSA modules, OpenSSL modules. There's other modules out there as well. These are just representative lists. They're not intended to be all-encompassing. But this is an important piece of the puzzle because some of the challenges that we're facing are directly because of we are using a FIPS inside approach in some cases. And a lot of that also sometimes stems from the fact that we have, and nearly all of our software is heterogeneous. it is intended that we encourage customers to run it not just on Oracle, you know, Red Stack kind of components, but you could take database and run it on HP or IBM or other hardware. And so in trying to keep a consistent FIPS 140 story, there are certainly some challenges that arise from this heterogeneity and the use of modules. And one other point I would like to make is that, you know, often, especially for operating systems and general purpose products, you'll see that those products incorporate multiple modules. So it's never just a one and done situation. In fact, you know, with operating systems, there could be many modules. Database, there are many modules used by those products. So looking at this from the customer perspective, you know, we sat back, and I've been working with customers kind of hands-on for about 18 years in the security capacity. And I wanted to share with you some of the higher level areas where we've seen some pain related to this. The first is related to education and awareness. And I'm going to drill down on each of these in just a moment. But it's about really the consistency of education and awareness across the federal landscape, the DoD landscape, and other customers who are concerned about FIPS 140. We also run into situations where customers, because often there is a lack of awareness, there's also challenges in terms of how they compare products, how they compare competitive products, how they even compare the FIPS 140 listing, the CMVP listing, with what a vendor provides. And so we'll share some of those examples. And lastly, some operational decisions, sometimes some not so good decisions, but things that are impacting here and that are all stemming from really understanding where and how FIPS 140 applies, how it applies to their environment, when they need to enforce it. So in the context of the broader goal of this session, before we can talk about evolving requirements, we need to understand how are customers just dealing with regulation, really, that's been on the book for, nearly 14 years. So in terms of education and awareness, well, the first issue really is a simple versus complex viewpoint. And I think FIPS 140 can be extremely simple and easy to understand in one breath and very complicated and difficult to understand in another. And it really comes down to perspective. When you're talking with someone in a procurement organization, it's very easy for them. They just want to know, does it have a FIPS 140 validation or not? Yes or no? It's a Boolean answer. And if you say no, you could be disqualified from that procurement cycle. Very simple. But as we know, the answer is often very far from simple. It gets into a lot of nuanced discussion. And you know, I've had the pleasure of working with a number of customers who've really pushed us on this matter. We said, well, here's the certificate. Okay. And show us the CAVP certificates. And tell us exactly how what modes and key lengths and everything else your product is using. And we want to make sure, beyond any reasonable doubt. Well, to answer some of those questions, you really need to understand FIPS at a much greater level, and that involves diving down into some of these publications. Another area is with respect to specificity. And this is something that we're trying to improve our own product documentation, and certainly we'd encourage other vendors to do the same. All too often, you'll see things in marketing literature, it's FIPS, yeah, we got it. It's not even FIPS 140, they'll just say FIPS or something like that. In the same way, in the product documentation, it'll say, oh yeah, everything's encrypted. Okay, how is it encrypted? Very often, our customers come to us and say, well, you know, we need to satisfy our auditor, and we need to know exactly what algorithm is being used. You say it's encrypted, so, you know, and this is why we're trying to improve the documentation so that customers have all that information at their fingertips. But unfortunately, universally across the IT landscape, it's very hard to often find answers to these questions. And so once you get past, is it encrypted? Okay, yeah, it's encrypted. We use AES. Okay, well, some of our customers, particularly those in sensitive environments, I know, for example, the Department of Homeland Security, they have a sensitive systems security policy. They require AES 256, so saying just AES is often insufficient as well, although that's a little bit outside the scope of the FIPS 140 discussion. Then we have this is probably the most recurring thing that we have, is customers will always ask us, is product X FIPS 140 validated? Now, keeping in mind that, as I said before, There is not necessarily a one-to-one mapping between products and cryptographic modules. This is a very, you know, delicate answer. And so it often comes down to use cases. Because, you know, a given cryptographic module in a product, if it has multiple modules, think about this as an operating system. You know, you may have some modules that are working for OpenSSL and use services built on OpenSSL. You may have things built on Kerberos or IPsec or all of these other cryptographic functions could be using different cryptographic modules under the covers. And we see this a lot, you know, with some of our Linux work. There's quite a lot of cryptographic modules on the Linux side. The same is true, though, for some of our other products higher up the stack. And so it's important as we step back and look at this, we want to understand, you know, how do we answer, is WebLogic X certified? Well, the way we've been doing it is through product documentation. And what we do is if we can make a broad claim, we can make that broad claim in the documentation. Here's the modules we're using. Here's the certificate numbers we're claiming against. Here are the use cases that are supported for that purpose. Another side of the equation is, you know, you get customers who are starting to get much better trained and saying, okay, we need to care about FIPS. We need to know if it's validated. I'm going to go to the CMVP listing. Oh, wait a minute. Your product's not there. Well, any product that leverages a FIPS inside strategy is necessarily not going to be there. And unfortunately, it would be nice if we had an equivalent CMVP listing for FIPS inside products that could be validated in some way to say, you know, you could have this. But we don't have that today. And so now we're in a situation where, as a vendor, we have to tell the customer, well, trust us. This is the module that's in the product. Well, that's not really, you know, where we would like to be. But unfortunately, there's very little that we could do, you know, when leveraging a FIPS inside strategy here. Now, another interesting tidbit is really comparing apples and oranges. And this gets into how the different modules are and the numbering associated with modules. If I went in and decided that my cryptographic module was version 3, and that's it, I didn't provide a 3.x or 3.x.y, well, that could potentially give me longer life of that module, whereas customers who look at it and say, wait a minute, you're at module 3.1.2, and now you're telling me your product has 3.1.3, you need to go reevaluate. You need to go redo everything. And this is not so much, I want to step aside of the question of whether revalidations are necessary, but it's a consistency problem in how modules are documented, that some modules can get away with very, you know, degree, you know, very ambiguous versioning, 3.x or 3.0, whereas some will get to micro and micro versions like 3.0.1, 3.0, whatever. We also have the challenge of mapping, and this is from a customer perspective, mapping the cryptographic modules back to those use cases. If I know as a customer I want to establish a TLS session between two products, okay, that's great. If a product has multiple cryptographic modules, you know, again, going back to the Linux example, how easy is it to tell for any given Linux utility that has cryptography which cryptographic module it's using? Without getting in there and looking at how the thing is linked and looking at the source code or looking at the build instructions, it is not something for an average user. Developer, sure. But not for an average user to answer some of these questions. And unfortunately, what this means is very often, you know, customers don't have the wherewithal to actually, you know, discover whether or not they're in compliance, because it may be, and I can tell you with certainty, that despite some of the Linux vendors out there doing quite a large number of validations, that's great, and they probably hit 80%, there's still other cryptographic modules in those operating systems that aren't validated. And so what do you do? How do you know if you're using one of those use cases? You really don't. It's a real challenge today. And lastly, you know, it's about cryptography and nested products. So let's say I had an application server, and that application server was using Java, and I had a Java provider that I had went and done the FIPS 140 validation. Well, very often, especially for products that are sold to an international customer base, very often FIPS 140 is not enabled by default. So first and foremost, you need to know how to turn on the knob and enable FIPS 140 operation. But then beyond that, what about products layered on top of that application server? How can you guarantee that you're still using the FIPS 140 crypto, especially if multiple cryptographic providers are there? And that is another challenge that we see, that we have situations where you start layering and bundling products. In the cloud space, a great example is the use of containerization. We see a lot of interest in our customers to take things like Docker images. And so inside of a Docker image, you will have Linux. Inside of Linux, you may have an application server or database, and you stack all these things up. You know, at what point, you know, where's the boundary? And how do you know that you're actually running in compliance? It's a really, again, challenging process. On the operational front, and this is real. This blows my mind, but, you know, customers sometimes don't fully appreciate the requirement. If you go to the NIST website, it's very clear. If you're using cryptography to enforce a security policy or some protection, it needs to use FIPS 140 validated modules, needs to be operated in FIPS 140 mode. Yet, I still hear customers all the time, well, you know, I'm only concerned about the TLS session, or I'm only concerned about the operational data path. I'm not worried about how people are getting in over the management interfaces, or I'm not worried about how passwords are generated, or any of these other things. And this comes down to an awareness issue, but it impacts their operations, because very often, again, with different cryptographic modules, you may have enabled FIPS mode, but it may not be for all the use cases that you think you are supporting. We've also had customers go with these ill-advised workarounds. So they weren't sure, or they maybe were using a product that didn't have FIPS 140, so rather than try and seek a product with FIPS 140, you know, it's better just to not use crypto, because then FIPS 140 doesn't apply. Really? You know? So sometimes they will actually take that next logical step and say, well, we should have some other compensating controls and we should figure out what to do with that. But it is all too common that, you know, I want to use this product. This product doesn't have what I need, so I'll find a way around it. And that's what we've seen. And then the lack of organizational expertise. As I mentioned, you really need people with a strong background in different disciplines when you're having a FIPS 140 discussion. Having a discussion with someone in procurement, it's going to be a different kind of discussion than someone in a compliance role. And so, unfortunately, more customers tend to have people that are at the acquisition side of this spectrum and who can ask the question, is it FIPS 140 validated or not? But the minute that you have one other discussion, you want to try and take it deeper, or for whatever reason, maybe you want to have a little more nuanced argument, they're not able to support that. Now, like I said, I've had the pleasure of working with a couple customers where they wanted to go as deep as we could go, and it was great. It was great working with them, and they were all happy in the end. But unfortunately, too many are at the checkbox side of that equation. So from a customer perspective, I think it's important to understand, you know, that we need to understand the unintended consequences of developing policy. Developing policy is great, but unless we have a way to ensure that people understand what that policy is, what it entails, and have a plan for the adoption of this, and in particular with FIPS 140, across something the size of the federal government, trying to get a consistent, you know, adoption, awareness, and enforcement across something that large is extremely challenging. But if we don't, it leads us to a point where we have very inconsistent application. You know, during the time I was working with those customers, you know, I would say 5 years ago, FIPS 140 almost never came up, despite it being on the books since 2001. And it's only really been the last 3 to 5 years that we've started to see a much more concerted effort of customers asking us about this. Now, keep in mind, product development dollars need to be spent based on where customers are seeing value. And if customers weren't asking for it, that poses challenges for those of us who want to see these standards enforced. And so now that we're starting to get that interest and we get that customer demand, that's great, but product development life cycles are 3 to 5 years, usually at a minimum. And once that product comes out, the customer adoption of that new release could be another 3 to 5 years. So we need to plan for this when we are making changes to these kinds of standards. Otherwise, we're at a point where we're actually reducing security, because people will find the shortest path to satisfy their need, and that may involve actually just turning this stuff off. So with that, I would like to transition.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Oh, don't I look like a guy from Motown?
Yeah, I love
love that song. It came from the civil rights movement, and Sam Cooke was talking about a huge change in a civil movement in the 60s. But really what's needed here is a change in the waterfall process of implementation guidance. We vendors are drowning in it, and we've got some ideas about how to improve that. I have to say, I mean, some of the stuff I've heard, even at the conference today, has given me a lot of hope, and I've been tweaked some of the slides based upon some of the stuff I've heard in hallway conversations, and things are coming up. So kudos to this community, as you'll hear. So this is not a gripe session. I actually think there's a lot of hope, just as he did. So let's take a step back for a second and really think about the old-fashioned, what do people want? You're going to have to bear with me because I'm going to have to go back and forth with my glasses. As far as I can tell, NIST and the CMVP want the strongest crypto now for their customers. What do we want, vendors? So I can say that Oracle wants the strongest crypto for our customers with the least performance impact, and also that works internationally. So let's be clear, the strongest crypto may not actually be something we can work with everybody else, but now there's some kind of an international crypto CMVP that's being proposed. We'll see. Customers, well, they want the highest security for their products, but they also don't want to spend a lot of money on that. So what's the problem? Problem is how we get there is not working. So I've been pitching, and when I've been talking to people in the hallways, I'm going to finally reveal this now, an algorithm that has been used by pretty much everybody within the FIPS program, in my opinion, but is not approved. It's called the shampoo algorithm. If you've ever looked at a bottle of shampoo, instructions are pretty clear. Wash or lather your hair. Rinse it out and repeat. Wash, rinse, repeat. Wash, rinse, repeat. And really, at the end of the day, when you run out of shampoo, that's probably when you could literally have to get out of the shower because you ran out of shampoo. Other than that, you sort of have to use your better judgment. This is actually, interestingly enough, has been used in many introductory computer classes in high schools and colleges to try and get people not to write code with endless loops. But it also can apply to policies and how they are rolled out and input is provided. So let me see if I can expand on that. Is CMVP guidance following the shampoo algorithm? So what happens? NIST and CMVP issues draft guidance. We receive it. We provide feedback. And it looks like on the surface, when the draft becomes final, that we have a collaborative arrangement. Problem is, we don't know why comments are accepted or not. And we're not really at the table at the start when the guidance is written in the first place. So it's an endless loop that doesn't really result necessarily in both parties being happy, or in this case, a nice, clean head of hair. If some of you don't have hair, then maybe it doesn't apply. So what we're trying to do is get to a place where we're all working together. So let me see if I can take this analogy a little further and bring it back to the business side of house. And then I'll come back and get you out of the shower. So we have a couple of challenges here that I'm going to explain and let you know how Oracle reacted and what happened. And the first one is about AES GCM IV generation, which the original standard was published way back in 2007, and there were two IGs issued associated with that. So everything was sort of just fine around that, and in 2009, NIST published IG A.5 Key IV Pair Uniqueness Requirements, which stated that external IV generation is not allowed. So we, that is Oracle and most vendors who were in the software business, interpreted the word external to mean outside of the physical cryptographic boundary. As most of you know, NIST defines two boundaries for software crypto modules, a physical boundary and a logical boundary. Because our IG generation was performed within the physical boundary, we didn't see this as an issue, nor did anyone else. Only when NIST provided clarification that the IV generation had to be performed within the logical boundary did it become a problem. So, in 2014, my understanding is that the NIST standards research group found out that an application had an implementation of AES GCM where it provided an IV that was contained solely with zeros, meaning that there was a high probability that the implementation could be compromised. So, it was overhauled. And the new IG was effective immediately, which suddenly created a huge problem, specifying the only allowable methods for EAS GCM IV generation. So what did we do? I'm not going to say what product. Probably wouldn't be too hard to guess, but not my business to do that. When the new IG was issued, we stopped all ongoing work. Now, just so you know, anybody who's in software or hardware, there's always ongoing work. We stopped, and what we did is we analyzed it and did a gap analysis, and we wrote up a proposal. Took a lot of time, a lot of thought, involved our architects and key people within the organization, and we sent it off. We thought was a compromise because it was not something that we could quickly fix, and we wanted to meet the spirit and at the same time not create some kind of special problem for NIST, because we recognized that the issues they found were real. While we were waiting for a response, CMVP came out with another IG. And then on August 7th, the new IG became effective immediately. We never heard back on our proposal. To me and to Oracle, I mean, I just felt like that was not really working together collaboratively. So let's go on to example two. This is another fun one. This is about entropy. Back in 2012, NIST released two special publications, which you're all familiar with, 890 B and C, for comment. The comments were collected, but as far as anybody could tell, the SP was never finalized. And then in August of 2015, IG 715 is published. Effective immediately, no grandfathering, new requirements for entropy assessment for labs. And as mentioned, many companies, including Oracle, use third-party components to provide certain functionality, to improve performance or to provide a source for that entropy. And guess what? We don't have the ability to test or assess the entropy provided by that third party unless they are willing to work with us. Some have, some haven't. Sometimes they say, sorry, that's proprietary, none of your business. What are you supposed to do? So what do we do? So as I mentioned, this particular product gets entropy from a third party. We were under review, so the project was almost done. Didn't have any ability, and the third party was unwilling to work with us. And, you know, you can say whatever you want about their willingness to work with us or not, but I think that's not the point. You can't necessarily expect that a third party is going to provide something, because guess what? This is intellectual property. We actually ended up volunteering to the CMVP some information that we did have and was accepted for CMVP for previous evaluations of the same product. And then we begged. And we got a waiver. So is that a business plan? You know, you're putting together a project schedule, and you go through it, and you say, we know when we get to the end, we're going to make a few phone calls, and we'll get an exception. You can't build your business on that. You build your business based on the policies that are available, and you build your code and your products to that. We got a special favor. Others probably get special favors. Others don't. Is it fair? Probably not. But at the end of the day, you know, we worked it out for one product. We have a big problem down the road. But it's kind of like tomorrow's problem. So, you know, for the next project, we probably won't get a waiver. I don't know that we figured out how to solve this problem. Negotiation, pay more money to the third party, rip the third party out. These are all on the table. So how do you get out of the shampoo algorithm, this vicious cycle of not working together? By the way, this is actually, it was an off-Broadway musical called Wash, Rinse, Repeat. I don't think it lasted very long, but it looks pretty funny. So essentially, how do you get out of the shower? Now, a lot of this stuff is really great because we wrote these slides 4 or 5 months ago, and to see some of the things that are happening with the CMUF really makes me feel good. I know that the guys from NIAP are going to be like, really? He's giving us props? But I am. Take a page from NIAP and work together to solve problems. That's step one. Now, you can get into semantics about leading and not leading and how, but there, what NIAP has done with technical communities, no one else is really doing within the entire CCRA. And I'm not going to get into, if you want to talk to me more, you're not a common criteria guy about what that is, I can talk to you afterwards. But actually, what they've been able to do is really engage with industry. Because you know what? They admitted, hey, we're not product experts. And I look around this room and in the other two rooms, and I see some of the smartest people you could ever engage with. And I know NIST and the equivalents up and our friends in Canada have a lot of smart people too. But we're talking about product experts. That's the difference. For IGs, absolutely. We understand that you've got a standard and you've got to say how to use it. Let's work together about how to do that. Let's understand all the different issues, and I bet you if you get the right people in a room, you might be able to come up with something that works for industry and also doesn't allow for things like clear text bugs or major issues to be something that you allow to be regularly available to customers. Let's do it for, there's going to be a FIPS 140-4 someday. We know what that's probably an early draft for all, and coming along. Whatever various things that are coming along, let's get people are interested parties, let's work together and start to make sure that down the road, vendors and customers and the government, we're all kumbaya about what's coming out. Let's stop throwing things over the wall and work together to come up with a consensus. And let's talk about timing for a second. As we're getting towards this new world, we still need to think about transition management. Give us time to react. I don't care what it is. There's no way that big companies can just boldly go where no one's gone before and slam in a fix that's not going to cause some repercussions somewhere else, whether it's Solaris or the database or you name your favorite product that's out there. These are very complex enterprise products, and it takes a lot of time to figure out how to make changes. It's one thing to find a little vulnerability and patch it. It's nothing entirely to come out with a completely different approach to doing things like entropy. Every reactive response that we have prevents new features, new security features, new bug fixes being rolled out to your customers. We do not have unlimited resources. And while we're on the topic, I have to tell you, I mean, when I saw the agenda and saw that NIAP and NIST were presenting today, I was like, wow, that is huge. I mean, I'm impressed. I think it's a very good thing. It's time to get back to being a partnership. That's what NIAP was supposed to be. And so let's now that there's all this overlap, you've got entropy and protection profiles, you've got FIPS referring to outdated protection profiles, I'm assuming that NIAP and NIST have noticed this and are finally starting to work together. I'm looking forward to that panel very, very much. But let's work together. Let's see that happen. about the international proposal for CMVP that Randy made yesterday. I'm very interested in how he envisions this from actually happening. In the meantime, what also happens to companies like Oracle and other companies is that we still say if you want to sell to Brazil or Japan or whatever, they have their own schemes. And guess what? They don't recognize a FIP certificate. So then, even though you've already gone through this pain and suffering, you have to go through and do another validation in another country. Down the road, my dream is that you can do a certificate of something down the road and be able to sell it everywhere. Now, I know there's a lot harder nut to crack with crypto, but there's got to be some compromise in there somewhere where we could reduce the amount of rework. It's worth discussing. So I would like to, I mean, I don't know who, if there's anybody from at these conferences from some of these other schemes, but we ought to start, the organizers ought to reach out to those guys and see if we can get them to come. Maybe we can do a conference in Rio someday. As Glenn mentioned, the FIPS inside list. I actually think that this is impossible for the CMVP to know. It's got to be voluntary. There's got to be some method whereby if a customer wants to see documentation, that it's available. That's hurdles to get over. But I can tell you that Oracle will provide you a list. We want to do it. And if it was on a central location that was publicly available, that I think that would help a tremendous amount in the field. Point them, if you're not on the FIPS validated list, check the inside list. Oh, you're running RSAB safe. Good to go. Let me check. And it links back to the certificate. Oh, it's valid, blah, 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 move on. So, with that, I think you all have gotten out of the shower successfully. I'll leave you with one more analogy. When you finish the shampoo, okay, it doesn't mean you have to necessarily buy an upgraded brand of that shampoo. You might want to just use that same shampoo again for a while because it's working for you. Same thing on implementation guidance. Let's do some more kind of piloting of this stuff and make sure that there aren't any things that we don't know about. Like, for example, look at the results of using the shampoo from the woman on the left there. It's a little bit little bit too frizzy. Maybe it doesn't work for everybody. Let's do some thinking about before we roll out IGs, the downstream implications. So that I will take, we have a few minutes for questions. So there you go.
I said, you know, it's one thing to have a desktop, and a desktop can maybe iterate every 5 years pretty easily. Once you get into a situation where you're deploying a mission-critical service to your customers, or even internally, as I mentioned, finance, HR, ERP, whatever those supply chain, those things tend to run well outside of a five-year boundary. And then you have special regulatory situations. As I mentioned, life sciences, they're running clinical trials. They can't change this stuff mid-trial. It has to, you know, 21 CFR Part 11 has, I mean, there's some wiggle room there, but still they're very strict about, you know, making changes to these environments. So 5 years is, I think, insufficient. You would churn too much, and I don't think, you know, I still see customers, for good or bad, especially in the federal government and DOD, where they're using even technically unsupported versions of Oracle technology because they just haven't had the cycles to upgrade. They can't take that system offline, and they don't have the funds to build a completely separate one using new technology, so they're stuck in a position where they can't upgrade.
Requirements, it's pretty easy to go to a lab and have them do an audit of your installation
Absolutely, but when you're dealing with thousands of products, it becomes very costly. Well, exactly, and it kind of ties into maybe they understand it's TLS, but they don't think about the management protocols or the replication protocols, or oh, it's just replicating something. And but it's maybe using TLS or SSH or password verifiers. Everything has a username and password. There's crypto in there somewhere.